promotion spot number one for 1962 in review. 30 seconds.
The Sound of Integration at Ole Miss. The Oxford, Mississippi story was one of the year's best newsmakers. It, along with other news events, will be told in actual sound and on-the-spot reports when this station presents 1962 in review.
Promotion spot number two for 1962 in review, 35 seconds.
A strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound to Cuba from whatever nation or port where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back.
With these words, John F. Kennedy put Castroism and Khrushchevism on notice that we'll do whatever necessary to defend this hemisphere from communism. This story and other top news events will be retold with the voices of those who made the news and the reporters who covered it when this station presents 1962 in review.
A new year is born in hope. Young lovers dream of stars. A president also looks to the heavens, but from a slightly different angle and with different passions. His view is a mixture of pragmatism and idealism, the possible and the probable. 1962 was a fortnight old. In his State of the Union message, the president singled out space as the year's great challenge.
With the approval of this Congress, we have undertaken in the past year a great new effort in outer space. Our aim is not simply to be first on the moon. Our objective in making this effort, which we hope will place one of our citizens on the moon, is to develop in a new frontier of science, commerce, and cooperation the position of the United States and the free world.
But the importance of space in 1962 faded under the violent impact of events which placed their own stamp upon the year, events that did not always coincide with January's optimism or goals. This is 1962 in review, the story of a year. The year began with war still eating at the vitals of France and Algiers, South Vietnam gripped with the terror of infiltrator and communist saboteur. But few foresaw the explosions that would rip through the high altitudes of the Himalayas before the year ended.
The Sino-Indian boundary question is an issue between two Asian countries. China and India should settle this issue peacefully.
James Meredith, Negro, was knocking softly on the door of Mississippi's all-white university. And there was little anticipation of the anguish that would follow when the courts opened that door. And in the Caribbean, a bearded communist would drag the world to the brink of hell in the mightiest crisis of an eventful year. These are some of the great stories of the year selected by United Press International editors throughout the nation. You'll hear more on these and other stories that made history after this important message. The date, February 20th. The President's call for redoubling America's efforts in space was faced first by Lieutenant Colonel John H. Glenn. His goal, 3 orbits around the Earth. His flight was dramatic and successful. And as he rocketed above the United States on one orbit, he said,
This is First Step 7, controlling manually on fly-by-wire. Having no trouble controlling, very smooth and easy, controls very nicely.
In the science fiction world of outer space, it began to appear by late May that the nation's hopes of forging ahead of the Soviet Union might be possible this year. The next flight by an American astronaut, Scott Carpenter. He duplicated Glenn's 3 trips around the world.
Finally, TF qualified is verified. Manual is satisfactory in all axes. Fiberwire and auto is satisfactory in all axes. Aux damp is okay also. Over.
In cold reality, Russia still was in space with the Mostis. In mid-August, the world was startled, then applauded Soviet scientific skill for an almost unbelievable achievement. 2 spacemen in orbit on 2 successive days. Robert Korngold told that story from Moscow.
2 Soviet cosmonauts were looping the Earth every 88 minutes today in a historic display of Russian space prowess. The Russian spacemen are Major Andriy Nikolaev and Lieutenant Colonel Pavel Popovich, whose 2 spaceships, Vostok 3 and Vostok 4, are in full sight and steady radio communication with each other.
In late September, Walter Schirra spent almost 9 hours circling the world. It proved America, indeed, still was in the space race, but had a mighty leap to go to close the gap with the Soviet Union. Now from space to Washington, a city where politics is not only a way of life, it's the staff of life. It's a city with an endless tug of war, Congress on one end, White House on the other. And the vast bureaucratic machinery of government, it has no time for either. It's too busy with its own internal political struggles. What happened in this political jungle in 1962? For that story, here is John Chambers. His beat is Washington.
Congress quickly settled into its normal pattern. The president gave a State of the Union message. Democrats hailed it as a brilliant document, but the voice of Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen rose in dissent.
That I thought it was a little like a Sears Roebuck catalog, in that it pretty well covered all items with a markup in price. And I think we'll discover that that will be true.
Almost as the 87th Congress began, John Stennis, a Mississippi Democrat, touched off headlines with hearings. He chaired a Senate subcommittee probing the muzzling of military men, but it was another Southern senator, Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, who fired the investigation with his political views.
In the censorship of one of General Trudeau's speeches, we want to discourage the term world communism. Well, why do they want to discourage the word world communism, that term? Communism is a world conspiracy. And that is what the military people, I think, have an obligation to tell the troops and to tell the people of this country.
One of the big stories from Washington occurred in mid-April. Congress sought vainly to play a leading role. But it was the president who starred.
U.S. Steel is a giant among giants. For weeks, the corporation had been suggesting perhaps it's time for a price hike. The administration countered each suggestion with one of its own. The White House had been lulled into the belief that U.S. Steel would not up its prices. And then...
The United States Steel Corporation announced today a general increase in steel prices. U.S. Steel, which usually sets the pace on prices for the rest of the industry, said the prices of products will be raised an average of 3.5% or 0.3 cents per pound, effective at 12:01 a.m. April 11th.
The next day at his news conference, President Kennedy was grim-faced. His words were stinging as he drubbed U.S. Steel.
In this serious hour in our nation's history, the American people will find it hard, as I do, to accept a situation in which a tiny handful of steel executives, whose pursuit of private power and profit exceeds their sense of public responsibility, can show such utter contempt for the interests of 185 million Americans.
The president's solo became a chorus in which most every major figure in Washington joined in. Steele was lashed by senators and cabinet officers, but it was the president's words which stung the hardest. U.S. Steele backed down. By almost any reckoning, the 87th Congress was not a joy to the White House and the president's goals for his new frontier. Medical care for the aged died under the Capitol Dome. Federal aid to education was left to mold in the moist Potomac air. A proposed cabinet post of urban affairs was shoved under a committee rug. $1 billion was slashed from the administration's foreign aid bill. Yet it is possible the 87th Congress will be remembered, apart from its predecessors, for one measure, a revolutionary new trade bill. Hailed by the president, Democrats, and Republicans, it had a few outspoken conservative critics like John Tower of Texas.
It confers on the president unprecedented power to negotiate tariffs, particularly in connection with the common market. I think it gives this president more power than any president has ever possessed insofar as negotiating tariffs are concerned, and I think to a great extent places American industry at the mercy of presidential whim.
Congress was 9 months old when it died, tired, angry, frustrated, and facing elections a month later. But congressional leaders could look back over its record with a feeling of accomplishment, said Senate Whip Hubert Humphrey.
The full session gives us, that is, the two sessions of Congress, give us a very broad and comprehensive record of achievement, starting out with the minimum wage and the Area Redevelopment Administration, the comprehensive housing program, the programs in the field of foreign policy, the aid administration, the establishment of the disarmament agency, the Peace Corps. Then I might add, if you would single out one piece of legislation that was historic in its meaning and application, I would say it's the foreign trade bill.
From Washington to Algiers, from steel to war, a war which had been long and costly. France and Algiers alike had bled almost to exhaustion. Even the proud, imperious Charles de Gaulle had staked his political life, possibly France's future, on bringing fighting to an end. And then in mid-March, a ceasefire went into effect.
The Europeans of Algiers received the broadcast of General de Gaulle on today's ceasefire agreement in typical fashion. From windows and balconies, in spite of a cold night wind, they beat out on pots and pans or anything that came to hand the rhythm of Algerie Française, titi-ti-ta-ta, of French Algeria. OAS squads managed, as they've done before, to prevent the television broadcast of the general's speech lasting more than a few minutes. Then the television screen went blank and the sound died.
All was not yet peace in Algiers. First, it was ripped by fractional disputes. Who would run this newly independent land? And it was Ben Bella, reputedly somewhat too familiar with communism to win solid U.S. respect, who finally swept aside the opposition and rode triumphant into Algiers.
Ben Bella and his men entered the city in triumph to the ringing cheers of thousands of its citizens. Ben Bella is sticking to the ceasefire agreement, which called for a demilitarized city in Algiers. But his troops will be based close at hand in the city's suburbs.
Slowly, the fighting in Algiers died to internal problems. The mean, dirty jungle war in South Vietnam grew in intensity. American troops and equipment were moved in to prevent the collapse of that vital corner of freedom in Southeast Asia. But the big threat to peace outside the Western Hemisphere came neither from North Africa nor Vietnam. In areas long disputed by the two most populous nations of the Far East, the Chinese made the first move. They shattered India's illusions with the same suddenness that they shattered the peace. Michael Malloy from New Delhi followed that war.
India has suffered serious losses of men and ground on both ends of her long frontier with China. Casualties have been very heavy, according to Defense Minister Krishna Menon. His troops have lost four outposts in the Chip Chap Valley in the far northwestern corner of the country. But the biggest conflict has been on the northeast frontier. The Chinese there have pushed 5 miles past the line, which India recognizes as the border. So far, however, this has been only a frontier war, and neither side has dared to use airplanes to strike behind enemy lines.
After rolling back Indian troops on every high mountain front, the Chinese voluntarily brought the war to an armistice on their terms, according to Radio Peking.
Beginning from the day following that of the issuance of the present statement, that is, from 0 hours on November 22nd, 1962, the Chinese Frontier Guard will cease fire along the entire Sino-Indian border.
Two domestic stories were among the biggest stories of the year, and they rate number one and number two on the top ten selected by United Press International editors. We'll hear more about those stories in just 1 minute. A mob has a grim and ugly face. Howard Hodgkins looked on the face of that mob when it shrieked and howled for the blood of a man.
The story of Oxford began early in 1962. James Meredith, veteran, married, wanted to complete his education. The college of his choice was Ole Miss. Generations of Southern boys and girls had walked its quiet corridors, but never had a known Negro gained admission. Meredith was destined to be the first. He appealed to the courts, and the courts ordered Mississippi to open its classrooms. The shrillest voice against Meredith was the state's governor, Ross Barnett.
And in order to preserve the peace, and in order to maintain and perpetuate the dignity and tranquility of the great and sovereign state of Mississippi, under such proclamation do hereby now and finally deny you admission to the University of Mississippi.
Tension and anger mounted. Barnett's chief support came from extremist Southern groups. One-time General Edwin Walker threw his support behind the governor.
Two phones are ringing every 2 minutes. People offering aid and assistance to go to the assistance of Governor Barnett. There has been a cable in here saying that 10,000 men and women from Louisiana will be there.
No direct assault put Meredith in college. He was slipped in quietly, unexpectedly, through a side door, while hate, anger, and roving mobs covered the city of Oxford. Word of his admission whipped across the campus like a wild storm on a western prairie. Ole Miss erupted in riot. Masked federal marshals struggled to bring the riots to an end in a terrifying night of violence. Governor Barnett, perhaps frightened by the ogre his words and actions had created, cried for peace.
As chief executive of this great state, I now prayerfully urge each citizen to remain at home in his community. We must not have violence.
As night faded into a disturbed dawn, two men lay dead. Dozens were injured. Federal troops began pouring into Oxford, but the rioting had not stopped.
While the news of the enrollment of 29-year-old Negro James Meredith spread through town, violence continues in downtown Oxford, but on a somewhat smaller scale. Crowds of adults and outsiders have swarmed over the square down at City Hall and have declared war on National Guardsmen and regular Army troops who try to disperse them. Meanwhile, U.S. Marine helicopters continue to swarm overhead, and military convoys keep arriving.
Peace came slowly to Oxford in the face of federal strength. A tortured peace, which still rests uneasily over a college and a way of life. James Meredith still attends classes under guard.
At the height of tension over the Cuban crisis, with the world perched on the edge of Armageddon, Secretary of State Dean Rusk said, "The United States and the Soviet Union are standing eyeball to eyeball." And, added Mr. Rusk, "I think the other guy just blinked." Throughout that crisis, Pi Chamberlain Jr. was at the White House. He knows the story of the tense Cuban days well.
On the night of October 22nd, President Kennedy made what well may be his most famous speech. He revealed that offensive Soviet missiles and bombers were in Cuba, and more were on the way. He said,
to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back.
Reaction was swift. It extended around the world. From London, Don McKay reported,
the revelation of the Soviet buildup in Cuba will come as a shock to the whole civilized world. These were the words of an official spokesman at the British Foreign Office shortly after President Kennedy completed his momentous address to the nation and to the world.
From Moscow, Jay Axelbank.
The Soviet press this morning was filled with vituperative attacks on the American-Cuban blockade. The military newspaper Red Star warned that Soviet military units are in a state of combat readiness.
From Cuba, Pedro Bonetti.
The Cuban government at 8:15 has not issued any official reaction to the speech of President Kennedy this evening, in which he announced new measures to establish a stronger blockade to Cuba. The speech of President Kennedy was not transmitted to the Cuban people, but hundreds of Cubans heard it by shortwave radio.
In the Forum of the United Nations, U.S. Ambassador Adlai Stevenson and Soviet Ambassador Zorin clashed with angry words.
Mr. Zorin, let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
I am not in an American courtroom, sir, and therefore I do not wish to answer a question that is put to me in the fashion in which a prosecutor does. In due course, sir, you will have your reply.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
U.S. ships steamed at full speed across the Caribbean. U.S. troops at the battle ready were marshaled at hastily set up embarkation points in Florida. And that was when the Soviet giant blinked. Actually, the blink was a single Soviet ship which volunteered information to U.S. inspectors on its cargo.
The Soviet tanker, which was intercepted shortly after 8 o'clock Thursday morning by a U.S. naval vessel, was the Bucharest, en route from Russia to Cuba with petroleum. This is the first and only intercept to date in the Cuban quarantine.
Tension eased. On November 20th, President Kennedy again spoke to the world.
I have today been informed by Chairman Khrushchev that all of the IL-28 bombers now in Cuba will be withdrawn in 30 days. He also agrees that these planes can be observed and counted as they leave. Inasmuch as this goes a long way towards reducing the danger which faced this hemisphere 4 weeks ago, I have this afternoon instructed the Secretary of Defense to lift our naval quarantine.
It was announced that Russia had given in and pulled out her missiles. Armageddon had been turned aside, at least for 1962.
There were other major stories in the world, and I'll have more on those after this important message. It was an off year for elections, but the stakes were big, control of Congress. And when the last votes were counted, the Democrats had scored surprising strength. In Massachusetts, an old name with a new face, young Ted Kennedy could add senator to his title. In California, former Vice President Nixon missed again. This made it twice in a row. In anger, he attacked the press.
I think that it's time that our great newspapers have at least the same objectivity, the same fullness of coverage that television has. And I can only say thank God for television and radio for keeping the newspapers a little more honest.
Thalidomide was an unpronounceable chemical formula until something mean and ugly grew out of this innocent-appearing sleeping pill. The number of deformed babies in Europe increased. In the United States, a quiet public health service doctor, Dr. Francis Kelsey, almost single-handedly blocked the use of the drug until it was proven safe. And for her efforts, the president honored her.
Well, I know that we're all most indebted to Dr. Kelsey, the relationship, the hopes that all of us have for our children, I think indicates how, I'm sure to Dr. Kelsey, how important her work is and those who labor with her to protect our families. So, Doctor, I know that you know how much the country appreciates what you've done.
At the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church convoked its first ecumenical council of this century. A colorful ceremony rich in ritual, heavy with tradition, opened the convocation of church fathers, as reported by William Sunderland from Rome.
Pope John 23rd today called on world leaders to continue top-level discussions and to make the necessary sacrifices for peace. The 80-year-old pontiff made the statement to representatives of 85 nations and international organizations who have gathered in Rome for the opening of the Ecumenical Council.
Death came to two noted figures during the year. In Hollywood, that child of packaged cinema sex, Marilyn Monroe, stabbed the conscience of the tinsel world for a brief moment. Dr. Theodore Kerfey reported on the cause of her death.
Examination by the toxicology laboratory indicates that death was due to a self-administered overdose of sedative drugs.
Death also took one of the world's most beloved and noble women, Mrs. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Ambassador Stevenson spoke for all peoples when he said,
"The United States, the United Nations, the world has lost one of its great citizens. Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt is dead, and a cherished friend of all mankind is gone."
It started as a small cloud on the Texas horizon. Big-hearted, open-handed, smiling Billy Saul Estes, whose success story was legend, got into a little difficulty over fertilizer tanks. But before the year was over, the cloud was a storm. Billy Saul was convicted of fraud.
Former financial boy wonder Billy Saul Estes has been found guilty of swindling, but when he will serve his first day in prison is still anybody's guess. A district court jury in Tyler, Texas, returned the verdict of guilty last night and set the penalty at 8 years in the penitentiary.
During the year, the United Nations was more conspicuous for its ineffectiveness than its vigor. But as the year rolled to a close, a hint that perhaps the UN could become a more vital force next year occurred when East and West agreed on a permanent Secretary General, U Thant. In accepting the Secretary Generalship of the UN, he said,
"I do believe that I may be able to play a role, however humble, in the easing of tensions and in bridging the gulf between the major powers."
Of all the tragedies in transportation during the year, none was more numbing than the crash of a jet airliner at Orly Airfield, Paris. The plane carried 125 persons, mostly from one U.S. city. And William Boyd had this report.
Air France described the crash as the worst in their history. The airline pointed out that the number of persons on board represented the maximum load for the aircraft, a load which was not usually taken except in the case of charter flights. This flight was chartered by the Atlanta Art Association.
1962 was a year filled with drama, excitement, and history. Israel executed Adolf Eichmann for his vicious role in persecuting Jews during the terrible reign of Adolf Hitler. Robert A. Soblin, convicted of aiding Russia, escaped justice only to die a suicide in England. An earthquake took an estimated 10,000 lives in Iran. A new era in communication was promised when the satellite Telstar was put into orbit, and a mail truck was robbed in Plymouth, Massachusetts. The cash haul, a staggering $1,500,000.
You have been listening to 1962 in Review, the history of another year. In Review was produced under the direction of Herbert Gordon. This is William Liss speaking for United Press International.
And as the year ended, there was this last dramatic development.